Now in death, so-called, the etheric body leaves the physical housing, ceases to live on the physical plane, and becomes an inhabitant of this plane where everything is etheric, matter simply vibrating more rapidly than such substance as is seen ordinarily by men. We repeat this proposition to you, and you should repeat it to others as often as occasion is presented, because it is entirely new in physics, and so beyond the world's teaching that even with oft-repeated telling it will be found difficult of comprehension. It was with this end in view that great effort was made to give you the demonstration which we did. In further answer to your question, said the member of the spirit group, you must know, that there is no such thing as imagination, as that word is generally used. Your dictionaries define it as the image-making power of the mind, the power to create or reproduce ideally an object previously perceived, the power to call up mental images. There must exist the sun before there can be the shadow, the real must precede the imitation, there must be the original before the copy, the subject before the photograph. One cannot imagine something that has no existence in nature. The imagination must have something basic. The etheric mental lines or waves of the mind ordinarily move at will in and about the unknown land, and through the subconscious brain get impressions and suggestions, usually intangible and indefinite. Such wandering of the mind not being understood, an entirely false conception is obtained of the mental operation. Everything in the universe is real, is material, and the groping of the mind in the mental plane is called imagination, the word itself being derived from image, reflection, the likeness of something else. All this leads up to your personal experience. What you saw actually existed, the bridge was real, and the mother and the little son actually crossed, and came to you as you relate. But you did not see with your physical eye, you were alone in the great forest, and around you all was natural, there was perfect harmony between you and your environment, your thought was passive, and we, coming in close contact with your brain, touched and quickened or rather sensitized your psychic sense, and by that process you saw more surely than would have been possible with the physical eye. It is only on rare occasions that it is given to one without psychic sight fully developed to look into the invisible, and it may never come to you again. The bridge you saw was composed of etheric substance, actual and real, constructed by mental operations, rather than by the hands. The mind can only fashion gross matter into form by use of the hands, but etheric forms may be fashioned and changed by mental operation alone, and those whom you saw were your own. They had bodies, etheric bodies, and they were clothed in etheric garments. As you know, they are not lost, but live and progress in this, the mental sphere, waiting until the period of your development in the physical is completed. Then will come the reunion, the meeting, and, together, life everlasting. When will the mind grasp the proposition that all natural changes planned by the Master Intelligence mean progress? When shall we as a people be able to look upon the last great change understandingly? When shall we become big enough to think of the opportunity given to the one who goes forth, instead of thinking of our temporary loss? If the world would only comprehend that death means living on in more splendid environment, and that those who have gone forth continue to live in a world no less material than this, the burden of sorrow and the awful fear of what is called death would pass from the human heart. Ignorance is the parent of fear. What matters it whether one goes out this year or next? In the afterlife, time does not exist, and progress is eternal. Chapter 20 Power of Suggestion. The inhabitants of this invisible world influence and in some measure control the thought and conduct of every individual. They are more progressive than we, and having no incentive to accumulate money, devote themselves to the acquisition of knowledge. They delve deeply into the forces of nature, and dealing with matter in greater refinement, make from time to time discoveries, some of which are utilized on the physical plane. Faraday, who first made practical the force known as electricity, did not cease his investigations with dissolution, but has been a potent factor in its development through suggestion to those who devote their time to the utilization of that force. Raphael did not cease to portray upon canvas his wonderful creations, nor did Michelangelo lose his ability to chisel marble into forms of beauty when he ceased to inhabit this plane. The years that have elapsed since they went on, have been years of opportunity and progress. Mozart, Beethoven, and all the other musicians who gave us our great compositions, have they gone down into the silent and relentless darkness, or have they continued their work, impressing on others from day to day new music that enriches the world? Milton, Dryden, Pope, Goldsmith, Moore, Wordsworth, Burns, Browning of modern times, Seneca, Pliny the Elder, Plutarch, Epictetus, Tacitus and Cervantes, of an earlier period, were all their wonderful writings and philosophies produced without suggestion from the masterminds in the more advanced spheres. I know this one fact, that people in the afterlife are so close, so in touch with our thoughts that it is difficult for anyone to say that this or that is the product of his own intellect. Progress owes much to the invisible. Robert G. Ingersoll, well known to me in the afterlife, speaking on this subject said, "Let me give the most remarkable illustration of spirit suggestion, the immortal Shakespeare. Neither of his parents could read or write. He grew up in a small village among ignorant people, on the banks of the Avon. There was nothing in the peaceful, quiet landscape on which he looked, nothing in the low hills, the undulating fields, nothing in the lazy flowing stream to excite the imagination, nothing in his early life calculated to sow the seeds of the subtlest and sublimest thought. There was nothing in his education or lack of education to account for what he did. It is supposed that he attended school in his home village, but of that there is no proof. He went to London when young, and within a few years became interested in Blackfriars Theatre, where he was actor, dramatist, and manager. He was never engaged in a business counted reputable in that day. Socially he occupied a position below servants. The law described him as a sturdy vagabond. He died at 52. How such a man could produce the works which he did has been the wonder of all time. Not satisfied that one with such limited advantages could possibly have written the masterpieces of literature, it has been by some contended that Bacon was the author of all Shakespeare's comedies and tragedies. It is a fact to be noted that in none of this man's plays is there any mention of his contemporaries. He made reference to no king, queen, poet, author, sailor, soldier, statesman, or priest of his own period. He lived in an age of great deeds, in the time of religious wars, in the days of the Armada, the Edict of Nantes, the massacres of Saint Bartholomew, the victory of Lepanto, the assassination of Henry III of France, and the execution of Mary Stuart, yet he did not mention a single incident of his day and time. The brain that conceived Timon of Athens was a Greek in the days of Pericles and familiar with the tragedies of that country. The mind that dictated Julius Caesar was an inhabitant of the Eternal City when Caesar led his legions in the field. The author of Lear was a pagan, of Romeo and Juliet, an Italian who knew the ecstasies of love. The author of those plays must have been a physician, for he shows a knowledge of medicine and the symptoms of disease, a musician, for in The Two Gentlemen of Verona he uses every musical term known to his contemporaries. He was a lawyer, for he was acquainted with the forms and expressions used by that profession. He was a botanist because he named nearly all known plants. He was an astronomer and a naturalist and wrote intelligently upon the stars and natural science. He was a sailor, or he could not have written The Tempest. He was a savage and trod the forest's silent depths. He knew all crimes, all regrets, all virtues, and their rewards. He knew the unspoken thoughts, desires and ways of beasts. He lived all lives. His brain was a sea on which the waves touch all the shores of experience. He was the wonder of his time and of ours. Was it possible for any man of his education and experience to conceive the things which he did? All the Shakespearean works were, beyond a doubt, the product of his pen, but the conceptions, the plays, the tragedies were the work of many brains, given Shakespeare by spirit suggestion. He was but the sensitive instrument through which a group of learned and distinguished scholars, inhabitants of many lands when in earth life, gave to posterity the sublime masterpieces of the Bard of Avon. The writings of Swedenborg were produced in the same way. Sado wrote by spirit suggestion, and as a fact many of the best works of so-called great men have been in part the action of the minds of those beyond our earthly plane, who, working in conjunction with man, do something for the uplift of the human race. knowing as I do the potent influence of spirit people upon the world's thought, and how in every way they seek to enlighten us as to the change called death, I have wondered what spirit impressed this poem on a mortal mind, as the faint dawn crept upwards, grey and dim. He saw her move across the past to him, her eyes as they had looked in long gone years, tender with love, and soft with thoughts of tears, her hands, outstretched as if in wonderment, nestled in his, and rested there, content. "Dear wife," he whispered, "what glad dream is this? I feel your clasp, your long-remembered kiss, touches my lips, as when you used to creep into my heart, and yet, this is not sleep, is it some vision, that with night will fly?" "Nay, dear," she answered, "it is really I. Dear heart, it is you I know. But I knew not the dead could meet us so, bodied as we are, see, how like we stand." "Like," she replied, "in form, and face, and hand." Silent a while, he held her to his breast as if afraid to try the further test, then, speaking quickly, "Must you go away?" "Husband," she murmured, "neither night nor day." Close to her then, she drew his head, trembling. "I do not understand," he said. "I thought the spirit world was far apart." "Nay," she replied, "it is not now, dear heart. Quick, hold fast my hand, lean on me. So. Cling to me, dear. 'Tis but a step to go." The white-faced watchers rose, beside the bed, shut out the day. They sighed, "Our friend is dead." This is a substantial description of what is actually occurring from hour to hour. In the change as the individual catches his breath in the etheric atmosphere, and his vision is clarified as a result of throwing off the flesh tissue, he sees spirit people, like in form and face and hand, so natural, so unlike what one has been led to believe that it is hard to understand. But let us remember that the change is a natural one, that all nature's changes are for our good, planned by the Master Intelligence, in order that our opportunity for development may be increased, and we may grow more godlike. Knowing this, we can meet the dawn of the new conditions with confidence and courage. Man is a part of nature. His intelligence being developed and refined to a greater or less degree, he is an integral portion of that force which we term God. It is not necessary that we bend the knee and worship at any shrine or altar, but knowing that we are part of that intelligent force which holds dominion in nature, it is incumbent upon us to do no act unworthy of our position, to live where the best thoughts grow, day by day to strive to maintain the integrity and standards set for us, and ultimately to do our utmost to increase that force called good, or God. In all ages man has pursued happiness by countless paths and innumerable roads. Some have thought that within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king, it kept its seat. Some have thought that on the throne it sat and smiled, and have waded through seas of blood to reach it. Some have thought that behind the walls of splendor it made its home. Others, despairing of finding it there, have pictured the world beyond, where happiness could be found perfect and complete. But let us realize that there is only one royal road which leads to happiness, and that is to practice the plain, old, yet incomparable maxim: "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." These sacred words, uttered in different form 600 years before the alleged birth of Christ, fell from the lips of the great Confucius, and are today found in nearly every sacred volume of the world. Chapter 21. Never a secret in the world. There never has been and never can be a secret in this world. This is an entirely new proposition, which, if understood, would prevent much crime and unhappiness, and would enrich all mankind. There has always been an idea that many things can be done secretly, that, for instance, one can lie, and it will never be known, that one can cheat and defraud another, and not be found out, that a thief can enter a home without detection, that immorality can be carried on without society being the wiser. All these wrongs are being done under the belief that they can be accomplished secretly, and most of them are done in this manner so far as our world is concerned. Mankind has been taught that God sees all and knows all, but men and women do not believe it, otherwise crimes would not be committed, and the moral code would not be violated. Pride and the speech of people have a great influence on conduct. Now, suppose the thief knew that if he took the property of another, his act would, beyond peradventure, be exposed in the morning paper, and he would be under immediate arrest. With conviction absolutely certain, would he commit the crime? Suppose the businessman, or captain of finance, knew that if he formed unlawful combinations and defrauded the public, he would certainly be imprisoned. Suppose men and women knew that violations of the moral code would be known and censured within the hour, would wrong and crime go rampant through the land? Men and women do these acts in the belief that they are discreet enough to so cover them, that they will never be known. Such people have little idea that every act, I will go further, everything is known by those in the afterlife who are interested in our welfare. But they are far away, one says. No, they touch elbows and walk beside us day by day. One cannot comprehend God as a personality witnessing each act and knowing the individual thought of over 400 million of people, but one can comprehend the fact that the afterlife is inhabited by those who have passed through the earth life, that they improve their condition by helping those in need of assistance, that by their silent suggestion through the subconscious brain, they try to aid us, keep in touch with our thought, and are silent witnesses of all the wrong in the physical world. I do not mean that all the inhabitants of the afterlife know each wrong act. What I do mean is that every man, woman, or child has loved ones in the afterlife who take a deep interest in his or her welfare, be their position high or low. In other words, the ties of blood, the bonds of love, the interest of friends are not severed by dissolution. As the father, mother, brother, sister, wife, or child, know by experience the awful effect of wrongdoing, and are able to come about us and witness our conduct, note our mental vibrations and so read our thoughts, is it not the most natural thing in the world that they should try to stay our evil acts? If mankind knew this fact, that nothing is ever really done in secret, would wrong be committed at all? Men and women are restrained often by pride, they only stray from the path of rectitude when they think that they go in secret. Teach men the truth, and it will help to make the home sacred, to empty the prisons, it will add more than any other one thing to the sum total of human happiness. Again, the churches teach in substance that though our sins be scarlet, yet we can become as white as snow, and that there is forgiveness for all sin. One sect goes so far as to vest that power in the church. The practical result of such teaching has been and is, to license wrong and crime. Men do wrong under the impression that in some way they will escape the just consequences of their wrongful act. I have said before, and I will say again, that the world is not a jumble, but controlled by law, for every effect there is a cause, and that cause is governed by law. Every act produces a result. Every thought being material creates a condition about us, and is retained in one of the 16 or more million cells of the brain. When, therefore, anyone goes out of this life and enters the etheric where everything, the good and bad, is intensified beyond mind, measure, the storehouse of the brain is opened, and he or she is confronted with the record which has been made. Nothing is forgotten. The good get reward, otherwise courage would be lost. Punishment for wrongdoing is terrible beyond words. Everyone must bear his own burden, must meet again every wrongful act and make in ways that are provided complete restitution. This is very difficult, and the way is very long. One who believes that the world of men marks the beginning or the end has no more comprehension of the true situation than the mole, following the path which it has made under the dead grass in the meadow lands, knows of the physical world. I have been told the most important truths by those who have honored me by their teaching, that there never has been and never can be a secret in the world, that man has no savior but himself, and that the wrong which he does, he must undo. Whatever obligations he contracts, he must meet. I have had other teachings that have appealed most strongly to reason. One of these is do no worry, but fit yourself to meet situations from day to day. The obstacles which we meet are of our own creation. The troubles we have are of our own making. If we possessed all wisdom, we would then be gods, and not make mistakes. No one is perfect in this world or has reached full development, and until such time everyone as a result of lack of wisdom and judgment will continue to make mistakes and create obstacles over which he will stumble. But that is not misfortune, mistakes are necessary, and it is only by creating and overcoming them that we gain wisdom, and know how to avoid the same conditions again. They are the stepping stones to the heights of understanding, and are good for us. Let us meet them cheerfully and appreciate the lesson each teaches. Ordinary errors ought not to cause us anxiety, for it is only through them that we make progress. A just and full appreciation of this fact would take from the mind the useless burden of worry. Calamity is nature's spur. Trials are not only essential, but a disciplinary. Misfortune is opportunity. Other desirable things which I have learned from this unusual source are, we have no right to burden others with our sorrows. All nature is optimistic, all tending toward good. As one thinks, so he is. There are some men so pessimistic that given the choice of two evils, they insist upon taking both. They see no good in anything and are ever looking upon the dark side, anticipating misfortune. The mind is a wonderful force, its influence extending much further than we have any idea of, and one can do very much to make the world happier. On the other hand, one can do much to make others unhappy by throwing upon them one's own mental condition. And many people by force of habit do this, unmindful of the result. I recall not long ago a morning in the springtime. The sun was warm, the air balmy, dandelions bared their velvety bosom to the sky, tulips and daffodils fringed the borders. The lawns were carpeted with green, birds had returned from the south and were building nests and singing. It was a morning when a temperament that could not respond to environment was poor indeed. As I stepped out upon the avenue on my way to my office, I saw a prominent citizen approaching. His head was bent, his eyes were fixed on the stone walk, his mouth was set, dissatisfaction and unrest showed in his face. The impression, as his mental condition touched my own, was most depressing. I knew the man well. Involuntarily turning as I met him, I said, "Don't take that down into the city today."
"Take what?"
he answered quickly. "The countenance you are wearing this morning," I replied. He looked at me in amazement for a moment and inquired, "What is the matter with it?" I spoke with kindness, saying, "It is full of discontent, unrest, and worry. You look at war with all mankind. You will make miserable every man, woman, and child who sees you with your present expression." "Have I made that impression on you?" he asked.
"Yes," I answered.
"I would not like to create that impression," was the reply. "I have never thought that my mental attitude affected those with whom I came in contact. That is a new idea to me."
"Have you observed the morning?" I asked.
"No," he answered, "I have been so engrossed in thought that I have not observed the day." I then said, "I want you to forget the things you are worrying about. Look up and see how beautiful the world is, and feel what a privilege is ours to be a part of it. Listen to the songs of the robins, watch the bluebirds, respond to the flowers, get in harmony with it all, and as we meet those we know greet them cordially, and watch the effect on them and on yourself." He walked for a little way in silence. The suggestion was working, his jaws were relaxed, the frown had left his face, his eyes had kindled, his lips smiled. With his expression wholly changed, he walked, a different man. And as he met his friends and acquaintances with a cheery good morning, his joy and happiness radiated. Others caught the charm of his personality, the world was happier, and so was he. Chapter 22 Mental Activity. Thoughts are things. If not things, they are nothings, which is tantamount to saying that thought does not exist. If you design a house, your drawing is an image of the thought house which was in your mind before you made the draft. You see a certain vessel which is used for holding water, and you name the vessel a bucket. The image of that bucket is in your mind, and when you hear the word bucket, your mind recognizes the vessel either because you have seen it or heard it described. You use the word bucket in the hearing of 1,000 people who have seen or known of the same bucket, and every person of that 1,000 will perceive in his mind the exact image of that bucket. The word bucket is not in the image of the object, but when spoken refers the mind of the hearer who has seen it to the image of the bucket as it is indelibly printed on or in his psychic ether. Drawings are things, images are things, emblems of other things. From these drawings, images, and emblems of things the mind constructs the particular thing in psychic ether, and this psychic house, bucket, or other thing, is the thought,
and wrought in material form is the shape and counterpart of the spiritual thought. It is absolutely impossible for the mind to be inactive for one single moment, whether in sleep or awake. The matter composing the mind is in a state of constant activity, so intense in its vibratory action that it is impossible for that substance to be inactive for one instant. The brain in which ideas are fashioned is a perfect machine in constant motion. The creations or product emanating from such instrument are never visible unless physically clothed, and only a very few mental conceptions ever find expression in this world of ours. The mental products from millions of minds in active operation vary as do the products that come from the machines in the countless factories. The mental emanations flowing from a brain highly developed appear to spirit people as lines of force extending and undulating from the soul center. The longer those lines of force, the more active the substance composing them, and the lighter their appearance. The electric or gas light, as we use that term, is simply burning substance in a high degree of activity, and the greater the activity, the more perfect the light. The mental emanations going out from great, generous souls are light. Those from one selfish and cruel are slow in action and necessarily have a dark appearance. It is like comparing the flame of a tallow candle to the incandescent lamp. Thoughts again may emanate from a brain so undeveloped as to give out but little light, in reality casting a shadow in the etheric atmosphere. There are millions of those lines of force or emanations going out from mentalities continuously, and they make up what has ordinarily been termed the auras of individuals. Much talk of the aura surrounding each individual has been practically meaningless because of the failure to comprehend that mind is matter, and that thoughts have form and substance. Admitting this hypothesis, we can see at once how every individual is surrounded with thought emanations that go out from his mentality as the perfume goes out from the rose. It may be sweet and intoxicating, or it may be sickly and offensive. There is scarcely a state in which man finds himself that has not its counterpart in vegetable life. Those emanations or lines of force are perfectly visible to the inhabitants in the afterlife, who know from actual observation the character as well as the thought of the individual. We in the physical world, not having eyes developed to catch those emanations, because of their very high potency, know very little concerning them. If we knew, our knowledge would revolutionize the conduct of men. But we feel the effect of those lines of force when we come in contact with them. Instinctively we feel the personality of others. Thought emanations from others, both in and out of the physical body, make an impression upon our subconscious brain, and these with our own suggestions are continually entering our brain machine, are weighed, are either rejected or accepted, and are expressed, so that there is a continual taking in and throwing off in our mental operations. It is a process as natural as the heart action and as little understood. Few people are able to tell the process through which and by which they reach their conclusions, but mental lines of force strike our mentality, come in contact with our own emanations, so that unconsciously we receive an impression and arrive at a conclusion as to the personality of another. The first impression that we unconsciously get is always the one which should guide us. These are thought lines, as I have said, have color, depending upon their length, and as there is no stagnation in nature, their general condition is constantly changing, that is to say, they are progressing toward the light or becoming darker. As the individual self reaches a high state of spirituality with good thoughts and aspirations, the graceful lines of force reach far, the personality is lighted up, and we feel the presence of a good man or a good woman. The ignorant who live for self, with uncontrolled temper and unlicensed passion, have little spiritual development, live in darkness day by day, and their surroundings are exactly in accord with their mental state, for every man occupies just that position in society which he is qualified to occupy. That must be so, or the law of cause and effect will be a failure. So we see that in our daily life we are creating a condition about us and around us, spiritually as well as physically. We are making a physical condition in which we live from day to day, and a spiritual one as well, and into the latter we pass at the moment of dissolution. When divested of the flesh garment, we continue in just that mental state which we have created and from which there is no escape, until we, by great individual effort, change our mental state and acquire new and higher aspirations and thereby create a better environment. There are some individuals who bring into a home peace, happiness, and joy. There are other pessimistic individuals who cast a gloom wherever they go. In the presence of the last named, the laughter of children stops. There are individuals whose personality is so offensive that we avoid them whenever possible.